Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFPU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to a Brock Associate Professor of Pathology and Anatomy about Alzheimer's disease. We talk to a Brock Master's in Pop Culture and CFBU Music Director, a student at Brock, about the all-pervasive pop culture phenomena today. And we find out about the three-minute thesis competition from an educational psychologist at Brock. Racing to the finish line in a blazing fast 60 minutes, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. According to Health Canada, January is Alzheimer's Awareness Month, and many of us have been affected either directly or indirectly by this debilitating disease over the last several years. But is it worse now than it used to be? And if so, why? Inquisitive Minds went looking for answers and found ourselves in contact with Dr. Brian James, an associate professor of pathology and anatomy in the Department of Health Sciences at Brock. Dr. James joined us in our CFPU studios recently to discuss Alzheimer's disease and research being done. And I asked first to describe the disease and how it affects the body.
Alzheimer's disease is a specific form of dementia in which very specific parts of the brain lose their ability to function. And they do that because of a loss of the nerve cells, the neurons, which participate in the activity of the brain in those areas. There are many other kinds of dementia, but Alzheimer's disease is by far makes up the largest component of the dementia range.
Now, most people would assume that it's an age-related disease, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, it isn't. And it's a tricky thing to talk about. One of the risk factors for Alzheimer's disease is aging, but aging doesn't cause it. It so happens that Alzheimer's disease presents itself most dramatically in people who are, for the most part, past their fifth and sixth decades.
Are there different types of Alzheimer's disease or simply different stages of the one disease?
Well, both are true. There are two basic kinds of Alzheimer's disease. The first is referred to as familial Alzheimer's disease, which has a genetic predisposition associated with it. And it constitutes somewhere between 5 and roughly 16-17% of the Alzheimer population. The other form of Alzheimer's disease is referred to as sporadic Alzheimer's disease. And for this particular kind of Alzheimer's disease, we don't really know what the cause of it is, although there are a multitude of theories out there trying to assess it. In terms of stages, yes, there are various stages of Alzheimer's disease, and we have clinical criteria which we use, Brackenbrack and some other criteria, where we can determine the evolution of the disease. You have to remember that Alzheimer's is an irrevocable disease. Once it's absolutely diagnosed, which is I'll talk about maybe a little bit later, it does progress, and it will progress. I guess, suppose an analogy would be if you imagine the developmental stages of a person from infant to adult. Alzheimer's in many ways represents itself as a reverse of that process, so that you will begin with some very specific nondescript symptoms, for example, little cognitive things that go wrong or memory lapses and so forth, and it will progress through all kinds of stages where you gradually diminish in your ability to relate to people and the world around you. And at the end of that stage, you virtually revert back to a position of total helplessness.
Do we understand why it happens, say, in some people and not necessarily in others?
This is an interesting thing. If you take a look at the population, roughly in Canada, 5% of the population will develop Alzheimer's disease. So why do some people get it and some people don't? In the familial cases, we kind of have an understanding that there's a genetic predisposition to producing amyloid, which is an element of some proteins which accumulate in the brain and cause dysfunction. But in the other cases, we don't. And there are numerous theories out there about what the cause of that is. And it becomes a little bit confusing because there are other processes sometimes associated with the presentation of the disease. For example, vascular diseases and hypertension, infectious diseases and so forth. But when we get to trying to figure out what exactly it is, we don't know. The particular theory that myself and my colleague at McMaster University are investigating is we believe that there is a damage to the tiniest blood vessels in the brain called capillaries, in which there is an inability to regulate the exchange of this amyloid material. This amyloid material has no function that we're aware of, but it is naturally present. It is produced in the brain and other parts of the body, and it is under regulation such that it can be removed from the brain and allowed to enter into the brain, facilitated by certain proteins on the lining cells of the capillaries called endothelial cells. And what we are investigating is the theory, it's called the amyloid cascade theory, that somehow there is an accumulation in the brain of this amyloid material which gets out of balance so that more of it gets in and stays in than gets out. And we can identify the names of the transporter proteins that facilitate that. And so in our research, what we're doing is taking a look at some of those transporter proteins and see whether they are out of balance in terms of our loss of function, in terms of their ability to regulate amyloid. One of the interesting things about Alzheimer's, and it's particular to Alzheimer's, distinguishing it from other dementias, is that these lesions accumulate in very specific parts of the brain associated with cortical function, with our thinking abilities and decision making, as well as memory. And why it doesn't occur somewhere else is part of the puzzle. So we're taking a look at the concentration of these transporter proteins in different parts of the brains to see if we can understand what the difference might be. The other thing is that this accumulation of amyloid material produces a lesion called a senile plaque. But there are other very characteristic lesions within the brain called neurofibrillary tangles, which accumulate a destruction of material within nerve cells, which allow the nerve cells to function properly. And that's a tau protein. One of the other investigations is to determine whether there's a relationship between the amyloid deposition and the buildup of tau protein, which destroys the neurons in various parts of the brain.
So would this be sort of like build up a plaque on your teeth?
Well, in a sense, yes, except that the consequences here are far more devastating, obviously. But it's a very interesting research problem right now to determine whether, in fact, there is a relationship there. Most of the research that is out there now that is not basic science research trying to understand how these lesions develop has to do with pharmacological research in terms of trying to develop ways to ameliorate some of the symptoms associated with Alzheimer's patients at various stages. And this is particularly true for memory issues. For example, people use Aricept and so forth, many, many other drugs in use. But also, as the progression of the disease goes on, there are many other factors that have to be considered. Many of these are emotional issues, loss of ability to maintain emotional integrity, also the ability to maintain bodily functions, including continence and so forth. And as the patient descends further and further into this disease process, all of those functions start to disappear.
Now, as I understand it, at least in some stages, it's the long-term memory that will remain intact, I presume,
yes.
Earlier.
Yes.
But the short-term memory, what you did prior to coming into the studio, for example,
sure,
you would totally forget about. Is that the case?
It's the case. That has to do with the morphology and structure of the part of the brain that it affects. It's a part of the brain called the hippocampus. And it is structured in a very specific way so that long-term memory is in a different place than short-term memory, and the connections to the cortex, to the neocortex, becomes less and less able to retrieve that information in the case of the Alzheimer's patient. In the Alzheimer's patient, that part of the hippocampus is destroyed first or becomes dysfunctional first, and then it will eventually progress to further and further. And then, of course, there are other parts of the brain that aren't affected by memory. So there are, for example, cases where Alzheimer's patients, part of the ability to ameliorate the life experiences of Alzheimer's patients is that many of them retain the ability to enjoy and even perform music, which is held in a different part of the brain, so it's less affected. But eventually that disappears as well.
That would have been a logical assumption, I suppose, that it's not part of your memory function, so that would remain intact until it progresses to that point of no return, if you will.
Right, that's true. What's different is the access to that information is a different pathway, and so you can't retrieve it as you would where did I put my keys and so forth. And people shouldn't get excited about, in their fourth and fifth decades if they forget where their keys are, so forth and so on, that those are sort of natural occurrences. For example, people are worried about it. People are phoning in now. There was a university down in Ohio. They put on a mini cognitive test on the internet so that people could test themselves to determine whether or not they thought they might have some form of dementia, not necessarily Alzheimer's disease. Well, so many people were interested in it that it crashed the website. But obviously, if you start to notice symptoms in family members or friends where they have a consistent inability to remember things or an increasing disability in terms of regulating things like financial matters in their life and so forth and so on, it's worth going to your physician always to go and have it checked out to make sure there's not some other thing going on like vascular disease or hypertension and so on.
Yeah, I read on the weekend about what's called the SAGE test. So you can do it yourself to sort of self-analyze, which is never a good thing, but in this case, maybe to reassure yourself that, okay, I'm not suffering from this, I may have another problem, or it may not be the worst case scenario.
Yes.
So is that useful in a case like this?
Well, it is and it isn't. It might be useful as a marker. This was the study that I was referring to in the Ohio University. The problem with it is like going to the internet or to Wikipedia to do a diagnosis. That's not expert material. What it can do is cue you and sensitize you to the fact that you've noticed, you've become aware that something's different and maybe we should check it out. But whenever you go and you get it done professionally, then there's a whole series, a battery of tests that can go on to do that. In terms of diagnosing Alzheimer's, there is an array of symptoms which certainly demonstrate the presence of dementia. But whether or not that dementia is specifically Alzheimer's, they're getting very good at it now, where 80 to 90% of the cases or diagnoses which are made by physicians can identify Alzheimer's. But still, it's a matter of doing a post-mortem examination of the brain to determine definitively that it's Alzheimer's disease.
I think with a lot of people, it's the fear of the onset of it that delays them from investigating further.
Yes.
Is this part of the problem? We refuse or are afraid to face it, so that's why we don't go to the doctor, as you say we should, and have it investigated.
Certainly that is the case for many people, because people have become aware because of media attention of the dramatic and drastic consequences of having this disease process, and particularly the caregivers and family members who gradually have to take on more and more of the responsibility of taking care of these patients. And ultimately, many of these patients will become institutionalized and undergo various procedures and attempts to at least make their life comfortable during that process.
But the bottom line is, if you walk into a room, as we've all done, and then you stand there and you say to yourself, why did I come in here? That's not, initially at least, something we should be particularly worried
about. Not if that's a once in a while thing, or if you are exhausted because you've been up all night, or because you're under emotional stress and so forth and so on. No, those are sort of natural things that occur. But in your day-to-day life, these things become repetitive and become apparent, and people will start to notice around you that there are things that just aren't right. You don't seem to be able to negotiate your life in the usual way. Then it's always worth investigating it. Unfortunately, there are so many people becoming diagnosed with Alzheimer's and in fact have it. In Canada right now, and I don't want to quote a specific number because different agencies fight over the number, but somewhere between 700,000 and a million people have it. And the preponderance of those who are actually diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease are women. And there's all kinds of investigations to try and figure out that. So it's not something that we can ignore. And certainly if I were someone who was responsible, for example, in the Ministry of Health, trying to figure out how much money we should set aside to deal with all of this, I'd be very, very concerned, because it is going to become a burden, because the projections now for the next 30 years are that those numbers will increase by 50%.
So it's not getting better, it's getting worse.
It's getting worse, and so there is this huge pressure in terms of doing research to try and identify the mechanism that we can intercept earlier on. There are all kinds of pre-disease diagnoses that we can start to use now in terms of measuring certain kinds of proteins present, in, for example, in the cerebral spinal fluid and in the blood, and certain kinds of imaging where we can start to take a look at the preponderance of those lesions that I was talking about. But it's not there to be definitive. The other problem is that as we age, those characteristic lesions are probably present in everybody. Well, they are present in everybody. It's the concentration in very specific parts of the brain that give a definition definition of Alzheimer's disease.
So we've talked about a bit of your research already. What other research needs to be done to better understand Alzheimer's and how we deal with it?
Well, at the basic science level, we're still trying to figure out how the amyloid gets deposited and doesn't get removed. That's number one. Number two, we're trying to figure out whether or not there is an association between the development of those senile plaques and neurofibrillary tangles and the loss of function of the neurons, which cause all of the problems that we are associated with. Those two things need to be identified, because the possibility is that if we understand that mechanism, that we will have a way of intercepting it early on. With these diagnostic procedures, maybe we can identify somebody in their fourth decade who is starting to develop pathologies which may lead to Alzheimer's disease, and then find a way to intercept that. That's really what we want to do. But there is continual research going on how to ameliorate the symptoms that do develop, whether we can arrest it, whether we can somehow pull things back. But that research is ongoing, and right now we don't have the answers to that.
How do we know if a family member or a friend we suspect has Alzheimer's? How do we determine whether it's senility or Alzheimer's that we're dealing with here?
Well, and that comes down to this diagnostic procedure that we have. There's enough experience now in the clinical community to do, for example, mini cognitive tests and other kinds of cortical tests, tests on our ability for decision making and so forth, where they've become fairly accurate in terms of certainly identifying a dementia, and probably in 80 to 90% of the cases identifying that it is in fact Alzheimer's disease. That tends not to be the issue, because if it's one of the other things that might cause dementia, for example, cerebral vascular disease or hypertension, or occupation was that of someone who was a boxer or someone, then we know that there are other forms that can produce. So we're fairly comfortable with identifying Alzheimer's disease. And we're fairly comfortable now with, at least in the early stages, dealing with many of the symptoms. We can't stop it, but we can deal with some of the symptoms. And now many of the care facilities which are dealing with Alzheimer's patients are experimenting and developing new techniques to help make the life of these patients within the community, within the residence that they're in, more a life experience in a positive sense. So we're starting to understand all of that too.
Yeah, I was reading about what's called the reminiscence
testing,
which I guess for want of a better expression, makes you cope with the situation better. How does that work, and how effective is it?
Well, it's effective and it works in the earlier stages, but at a certain point, the patient with Alzheimer's loses the capacity to negotiate those decisions. They simply can't override and make adaptions to the behavior. And this is particularly true when we get into many of the physical symptoms and the emotional symptoms.
Given the amount of research that's been done and the amount of research still to come, and you're at the forefront of it, you see firsthand what needs to be done in this. Do you see an end to this process dealing with Alzheimer's so that we have a solution to the problem? How realistic is that?
Well, as a scientist, I'm always optimistic and hopeful. There are literally thousands of laboratories and clinical studies going on which are trying to pinpoint and focus on a solution to this point. Do I see something happening in the next year or two? Probably not. But I would be optimistic that, say, within 5 to 10 years, we will have made remarkable advances in research sufficient to at least identify techniques which could intercept the progression of the disease.
What can we do if we suspect that someone we know is suffering the early signs? What is the first thing we should be doing?
Well, if you have a suspicion of symptoms which remind you or alert you to the fact that maybe this is Alzheimer's disease or some other form of dementia, then go and see a physician. They have the ability to set up a series of tests which can confirm whether or not that is the case, or there may be some other cause other than the development of Alzheimer's disease. The other thing that we can do, this is the age-old question, what do you do to prevent it? And grandma was always right, okay? You have a good, moderate, healthy diet, you exercise regularly, and it's the old use it or lose it. Keep active mentally. Other than that, you really can't do a whole lot other than be careful around abusing things. For example, alcohol is known to kill a lot of nerve cells. There's a newspaper story this morning about that very issue. So your brain is something you need to take very good care of, and you need to do all of the things that are appropriate for that. But I would say in general, a healthy diet and exercise and mental activity are probably the best protectors. And of course, the ultimate one would be to stay young forever, but that's not possible.
So exercise your body and your mind. It's not going to hurt.
Oh, it will never hurt. It will never hurt.
Dr. James, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed this.
That was Brock, Associate Professor of Pathology and Anatomy in the Department of Health Sciences at Brock, Dr. Brian James, talking about Alzheimer's disease during this Alzheimer's Awareness Month.
Popular culture might seem a rather odd thing to major in at university. I mean, who can take pop culture seriously anyways? But people do. And perhaps when all is said and done, are we giving pop culture short shrift in society today? Well, I had this discussion with one of the eminent CFBU-FM music directors this week, Jeff Lawson, who also hosts his own show Saturday mornings from 10 until 12 noon on the station. It's called Interzone Radio. He's also studying for his master's in pop culture at Brock. So I asked Jeff to join me in the studio to talk about music, popular culture, and how he plans to make a career out of all of this once he leaves university. I asked first about a case study he's doing on John Zorn at the moment.
John Zorn is an, I guess you could say, an avant-garde composer based out of New York City, and he is an incredibly prolific, incredibly intellectual composer. And so what I mean by that is that he is taking very disparate subjects and bringing them together to create musical compositions based off of literary texts, ancient chants, and exotic bird songs, just to name a few. So what my case study is about at its core is the marrying of popular music and film theory. And so I'm using the film theory's auteur theory to basically explore how and when we can apply this theory to popular music. And I'm using John Zorn as my case study. And so maybe I should go back and maybe explain a little bit about auteur theory to kind of know what and when I'm using this and applying it.
That was going to be my next question.
Auteur theory is a theory developed in the 50s by a group of French film enthusiasts, scholars, and directors in Cahiers du Cinéma, which was one of the leading, if not the leading, film journal of Europe at the time. And basically, the idea is that though films are produced in an industrial manner, in that there's many different facets coming together to get the finished product out there, the auteur theory suggests that the film is a vision or artistic statement of the director, or auteur, which is the French term for author. So what they're asserting is that a film is the end product or end vision of the author, regardless of production or screenwriters or anything. It's the ideal vision of the director.
But shouldn't they all be that way anyway?
I would say so, yes. And there's a lot of consternation and contestation, if that's a word, about the theory in and of itself. And we particularly see this through the work of a French theorist named Roland Barthes, who wrote a piece, I believe, in the mid to late 60s entitled The Death of the Author, in which he asserts that there is no such thing as authorship. And what he says is every text is a fabric or a weaving of other texts that have come before it. And this sentiment, I think, is echoed a lot of the times in literary circles. Cormac McCarthy, the American author who wrote The Road and No Country for Old Men and Blood Meridian and a lot of these other classic American texts, basically says the same thing. He says that the sad fact of the matter is that all books are composed of other books. And I think that we can suggest that too with music, or that the suggestion can be made that all albums are composed of other albums in a certain sense.
Well, you can't really escape that because everything, it's transmogrification.
Yeah, exactly.
If I'm going to make up a word like you did.
Yeah.
That's nature. That's art.
Yes, exactly. And I think that why I'm using John Zorn as my specific case example or case study is because of the tight grip that he has on the production, creation, conception, and dissemination of his music. And so what I'm saying is basically that when we're looking at a musical auteur or an auteur in general, how and when is the production and creation of his music? How does it lead itself to using this theory from film to talk about popular music? So in Zorn's case, he conceives and composes and conducts and produces all of his music himself. A lot of the time he plays on it, but he has a stable of musicians, what I would say, who really understand and know his music and really have developed a long line of albums with him. I mean, he's putting out 25 or 30 albums every couple of years. But what I really find interesting is that he is the producer, he is the conductor, he is the composer, he is the conceiver, and then that's just from the musical standpoint. And then from the commercial dissemination standpoint, he owns the record label, he has personal deals with distribution, and it's also a kind of a development of a large scene of like-minded people within New York with him at the head of it.
That's almost the dream of an artist when you come right down to it, because we always hear of an artist who goes into the studio, they've got a vision of what they want the end product to be like.
Yeah.
But the mandarins, the powers that be in the corner offices say, no, this is what we want. And they fashion it to be what they interpret that product should be.
Yeah.
That's the age-old dilemma for an artist. So to have, basically, as Zorn does, complete control over the product, because you control everything, then that's your vision. It's not diluted by anyone else. That's what you want to say.
No, exactly. And I think that's why Zorn lends himself so well to this case study. But that's not all that this case study is really talking about. I think the core or the heart of it is really the marrying of film theory and popular music together to kind of show that we're not living in a vacuum and that these individual areas of study are actually interlapping and blending in with each other. And I think that's really the heart of it because, I mean, if the case study was just, okay, I'm going to claim that John Zorn is a musical auteur. That doesn't really help us because we say, well, yeah, look, he's doing it all himself. This is his vision. And I think that, especially with composers, it leads itself less to a valid argument than if we were looking at somebody else. So what I'm basically trying to do is say, when and how can we use this often disparaged theory to open up new avenues for the study of popular music? And not even just necessarily popular music, but how can we use theories from different fields to talk about the same thing?
As you say, he's nothing if not prolific. I would term him a modern-day Renaissance man because he really does do it all.
Absolutely. And more and more he's becoming recognized as this. Before, it was mostly in highfalutin art circles that recognize him, but now we continuously see profiles of him in the New York Times and in the Guardian. You're seeing more and more reviews of his albums. You're seeing more and more, not just New York art scene media, but international media recognizing him. He was a recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship a few years ago, the quote-unquote genius grant. And so you start seeing more and more recognition of his work, and I think that will lead itself to more fruitful investigation in the future, because right now there's one book by a guy named John Brackett, which is entitled Tradition and Transgression, which is about John Zorn, and it's a musicological book, but there's no real exploration or case study of him out there in the academic world right now. So I think getting in on this study will prove fruitful in the future.
So there you go. If there's a book in you, there's the book.
Yeah. And I mean, with Zorn, because he is so prolific, there's multiple books there because of his work with art galleries, film scores. He has a series of albums entitled Filmworks, which are film scores he's done, and I believe it's up to 25 or 26 albums now. There's an entire aspect of Jewish identity that he promotes and he works through in his music, which I think it would be a very fruitful investigation as well. I mean, there's no end to the possibilities of study with this guy, and it's interesting that no one has really picked up on it yet. There's been a few academic articles, but outside of that, there's no study of him.
Well, see, there you go. You always have to find your niche,
yeah,
and you fill it. Looks like you found your niche and you're filling it.
Yeah, and well, even on my radio show on CFBU, Interzone Radio, one of the main goals of that show is to expose not necessarily the world, but our listeners to the works of John Zorn. And so I can play four or five John Zorn tracks a week off of different albums, with each song being a different genre. So it's very fruitful in both a personal and intellectual academic sense.
Okay, now let's talk about the other aspect of your field of study, which is popular culture at Brock. Okay,
yep.
I suspect there might be a collective raising of eyebrows from some corners, suggesting it might be, quote-unquote, a waste of time.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you've heard that before.
Yeah, and I've struggled with that idea myself in my own studies, but you really have to look at it in a broader context of, you're just going to look at movies, you're just going to look at music, you're just going to watch TV shows, and somehow an academic environment will be created out of that. I mean, that's not really the case at all, and I spend a lot of time thinking about the value and the necessity of studying popular culture in an academic environment for, I think, a number of reasons. The first being, what I see as the most problematic a lot of the time is just the way that our culture and our society is structured, and the way that, especially with technology, the advances in technology, we're surrounded by screens, we're surrounded by images all day, every day. And to be able to discern, I don't want to say the good and the bad, but to have a critical faculty about what you're viewing every day, I think is very important and is probably crucial for the young minds of today.
But therein lies part of the problem, I think. It's so all-encompassing. It's all around us. Mm-hmm. We don't approach it with that critical eye.
Exactly.
We just accept what's out there, mm-hmm. and we don't think about what it's telling us. Therein lies the problem.
Mm-hmm. It's a very real problem, and I think that leads to the importance of the study of popular culture. And I think a lot of times when students enter these courses, they believe that it's another Bird course for them. It said, oh, this is going to be a fun course. We're going to get to watch Family Guy, or we're going to get to watch The Sopranos or something like that. But when they really find out what we're doing, which is a critical investigation, a critical analysis of these texts and the broader ideas that are floating behind the texts, that's when they start to realize that it's not necessarily a Bird course, and it's actually more of an eye-opening way to access the media that they watch and they love every day, but in a critical way, which is, I think, ultimately the value of a liberal arts education. It teaches you how to think, not necessarily what to think.
Yeah, I think the earlier equivalent to terming this like an easy credit, if you will, an easy course, would be basket weaving. We always heard about, well, I'll take basket weaving and that'll be an easy credit to achieve. So basically what you're saying is that it will give you the tools to be much more critical and to filter out what is nonsensical, for want of a better expression.
Yeah, absolutely.
And be a better interpreter of the information that is coming at you.
That's exactly right. And I think your use of the term interpreter is dead on, because we always say that there are no right or wrong answers within pop culture. And I think in the social science in general, a lot of the times, you know, sociology, humanities, there's a lot of the times no necessarily right or wrong answer, but it's the way that you go about interpreting and formulating your argument or response to whatever text you're looking at. And I think the goal of popular culture, at least my goal when I was a teaching assistant within the program, was to help the students become expert interpreters of culture. So when you go home and you're spending 5 or 6 hours on the internet and there's all of these ads being bombarded, or not necessarily the best written articles, you can use the critical faculties that you've developed in the pop culture courses to then be your own interpreter, not necessarily have someone tell you what to think, but you are presented with an argument or what we call a popular culture artifact, which could be an ad, it could be a blog posting, it could be a video, it could be anything, and you have the tools now to interpret and to break down what the actual message is and if you want to buy it or sell it. And I think that's the main goal, I think, for most pop culture studies, is just to have people open up their eyes a little bit more and not necessarily accept everything that's being fed to them through the media and a lot of the times through social institutions in general. I mean, the government, political bodies, religious bodies, even though the religious aspect probably doesn't come into play as much as it once did. You can look at these texts coming into you and these messages that are encoded within these texts, and you can then interpret, as you said. And so I think that's the primary goal and the primary function of studying popular culture.
As you say, with everything that you are subjected to, you have to become an interpreter of that information. Mm-hmm. Don't accept it at face value. If it comes from the government, if it comes from a particular religion that you're associated with, if it comes from an employer, dare I say, mm-hmm. you still have to take that, interpret it, and read between the lines and say, what is this really telling me? Mm-hmm. You can't accept it all at face value.
Exactly.
There's that element of critical thought that has to come into play here.
That's one of the sad parts I think you see a lot of the times when money gets tight or budgets become untenable anymore. You see that these are the programs that get cut instantly. It's the arts, it's the humanities, it's the social sciences, and not to disparage any other academic field of study, but these are very valuable academic subjects to take into account because of that. It's the teaching of critical thought, and that's something that I think gets brushed aside a lot of the time, is because there's not necessarily one specific avenue to take with these subjects, so we just say we can cut them across the board. But the goal of each of these courses or each of these subjects is to teach critical thought, and that's something that I think perhaps is lacking a lot of the time in, I don't want to say general society, because I don't want to sound like I'm in this ivory tower here, but I think a lot of the time we could use more critical thought and less regurgitation, if that makes any sense.
Spoon feeding.
Exactly. Exactly. Spoon feeding is the perfect way to describe it.
Cut these programs at your peril. In other words, you know, let me play the devil's advocate here. Can there be too much emphasis placed on popular culture? Now, I may be asking the wrong person, because you're studying it, you're majoring in it.
Yeah.
But in today's society, can there be too much emphasis placed on it?
I think it depends on what the emphasis is that you're placing on pop culture. If you're taking pop culture culture as what maybe the mass culture theorists once did, as a distraction and as leading to a dumbing down of society. I think too much emphasis can be placed on it. And especially I think you see that within the mainstream news media. A perfect example is Paul Walker, the recent movie star who was killed in a car accident. When you turn on the TV, you're bombarded constantly. You go onto the internet, you're bombarded constantly. And this is not necessarily even just at a blogging level, but at a New York Times level, at The Guardian, there's these constant articles written about these individuals, Paul Walker being the example I'm talking about now. So I think that to value popular culture over what would be considered real issues, war, poverty, famine, political corruption, and that sort of major news stories, and a perfect example would be to take the Paul Walker case and value that over the Edward Snowden NSA surveillance cases, I think that that would lead to a problem. But I think, again, that's where the critical thought comes into place, because we're not going to escape pop culture. We are in pop culture every day. Even almost what we're doing right now could be considered an example of popular culture. So I think it depends on what emphasis is placed on pop culture and what you do with that emphasis.
Compared to a generation or so ago, when the media was not quite as prevalent as it is now and all-encompassing, pop culture was not quite as big an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it is now. So is the rise of popular culture inextricably linked to the more media-savvy generation that's here now?
I think I would say yes, because you get more and more outlets to broadcast these images when you've got your phone on you at all times and the ads on the sidebar are trying to sell you something, trying to sell you an image, a lifestyle, a set of norms, gender norms, or class norms or something like that. I think that before, when you'd have the radio, you would have the TV, you would have the movies, and you'd have the newspaper. But now, I mean, we've got all of that, but we have that at our leisure. So we have it in our pockets with us at all times. We have it on our laptops. We have it walking through on electronic screens. So a perfect example is in Brock University with TV screens, whether they're showing the latest Brock news or they're broadcasting advertisers to help them pay for the Brock news. I think that just the level of immediacy of the nature of pop culture now, which is constant alerts, everything on your phone, on your tablet, on your laptop, on your TV, when you're walking in public, I mean, it's everywhere now. So I think that the rise of pop culture definitely is linked to the rise in technology and the proliferation of technology that we have at our disposal now.
So where do you see popular culture moving to in the future? Is it dependent on whatever media platform we choose to hook our proverbial wagon to at that moment?
That's a really interesting question, and I think I'm not sure. I really don't know where the answer lies. I think that the development and the accessibility of pop culture definitely depends on media platforms. The more platforms you get, the more advantageous it is for advertisers, large media corporations to get involved with these, because in the end, it's about selling products. It's about selling ad space. And so I think that the more we get into personal devices, smart computers, smartphones, and the more that those things advance, I think that we'll see a rise in the level of media bombardment, I guess you could say, which is what I would consider a major aspect of popular culture, is the way that media is structured and shaped to influence the mass population.
So where does all this take you once your university days are done? What do you see yourself doing?
Personally, I see myself, my university days will probably never be done. My plan is to go and do my PhD after I finish my master's degree, which I'll be finished in May of this year. And then after that, my plan is to teach, to work in a professional academic environment, and to continue teaching, continue researching, and continue trying to uncover, I don't want to say hidden messages. There is no hidden message, because the message is placed within the text for a certain reason. And if it's hidden, what's the point? The end goal of these messages is a lot of the times to get people to consume whatever product it is that they're selling, or to sell a lifestyle, to sell traditional gender roles, to sell traditional class roles. And so I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a hidden message, but to kind of uncover the workings of the media. And I think that now, more than ever, with the rise of technology and the rise of image bombardment, if that term makes any sense, it's to help people think critically about these texts. And, you know, I don't really see myself doing anything else in the future. That's my main goal. And I've got a clear path that I see of how I can get there. And that's my goal.
You're riding the wave to the future.
Exactly.
Jeff, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that was CFPU Music Director Jeff Lawson talking about pop culture. He's, in fact, taking his master's in pop culture at Brock, looking at why pop culture may be getting a bit of a bad rap.
today. Although I've never done it myself, I can imagine one of the most daunting tasks as a university student is to defend your thesis in front of a panel of university professors. I would rather undergo the bamboo shoots under the fingernails routine, which is likely less painful. Now, imagine doing that thesis defense in 3 minutes flat, not a second more. That's the idea behind the 3-minute thesis competition, getting underway at Brock in late February with the preliminary rounds. The final will come up in April at the Mapping New Knowledge's Graduate Student Research Conference, and the winner of the Brock contest goes on to the provincial competition in late April at McMaster. The Canadian Association for Graduate Studies is sponsoring the first ever national competition in May. Joining us in the studio recently to talk about the 3MT competition was Dr. John McNamara, an educational psychologist at Brock, interested in studying young children with language and learning disabilities. I asked Dr. McNamara to explain the rationale behind the 3-minute thesis competition.
I think that the idea is to take something that is research-based, that is very academic, and make it accessible, and accessible to a general audience. It's taking something that we are, as academics, are used to doing, and sometimes is very complicated, and to take those ideas and very quickly deliver it to a non-academic audience.
3 minutes is not a lot of time. First thing I have to ask, why 3 minutes? Why not four? Why not five? Which most people would think would be a nice round figure.
I think historically this has been the 3-minute thesis since its inception. It's probably an arbitrary decision. The idea was born in, I believe, in Australia about 5 or 6 years ago. And since that time, it's been 3 minutes.
So this is a global thing then?
It's a global thing.
Okay.
It's relatively recent in North America. Around 2008, this kind of popped up in Australia and it kind of made its way through Europe. In the last few years, we've seen it at universities in North America. And in the last year, we saw our first Ontario competition.
I don't know if fun can factor into a thesis defense of any length, but is there a fun factor involved here, or is it just way too serious for these people?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good question. I had the privilege of attending the provincial competition last year with our Brock University representative, and I think it was quite fun. It was a fun atmosphere. The judges are non-academics. Now, that being said, there's certainly some pressure on the participants, but it was a fun atmosphere, and we try to make it a fun atmosphere at Brock as well.
But brevity is your best friend when it comes to doing a 3-minute thesis, and it may sound easy to encapsulate your thoughts into as few words as possible. That's easier said than done.
You're absolutely right about that, Mike. In speaking with the participants last year and the winner of the Brock University 3-minute thesis competition last year, this was tough. And everyone speaks about how challenging it is to take a thesis, which can be 100 pages when you look at the written document or more, and get this down to 3 minutes. When you look at the participants, particularly the people who do well in this, the people who did well in the provincial competition, it looks easy when they present it. It almost looks like it's off the cuff. But when you talk to those people, there have been weeks and weeks of preparation. And I know from talking to Sierra Holzhauser, who was our Brock representative last year, she worked tirelessly to memorize almost every word that she said within that 3 minutes. So although the winners make this look easy, I really don't think it is that easy.
Do they have to memorize that 3 minutes, or are they allowed to have notes in front of them?
No notes.
No notes.
It's one of the rules of the competition that you cannot bring anything up with you to the stage.
So you really have to know your stuff. But of course, if you've already written the thesis, you know it. Mm-hmm. The trick is making it 3 minutes.
Yeah, one of the eligibility criteria for the 3-minute thesis is to be in the latter stages of your research. That means that you do know your thesis, you do know your research, you do know your data. So yes, I think that the challenge isn't so much understanding your data as much as it is presenting your data to a non-academic audience in a colorful way. in a way that makes the implications of it very clear. As I mentioned, the judges at the local level at Brock and certainly at the provincial level are non-academics. So that creates a challenge in that we are used to talking to our peers and our colleagues, and we use the vernacular that we're used to. But when we are to say a term that we may use in our research circle to a non-academic, it really doesn't make much sense. That's the challenge of it, is to present it in an accessible way, but also present it in a way that highlights your presentation skills. So as much as we're talking about content here, we're also talking about presenting skills.
That is the hallmark of what I've always tried to do with my program. Take a complex topic, boil it down to the bare essentials, and talk about it on a level where everyone can understand the subject matter. I'm interested about non-academic judges for this. Where are you drawing your judges from?
Last year, we had a journalist from the St. Catharines Standard, and we had a communications person at Brock. At the provincial level, they had an Olympic-style swimmer. They had a professional musician. They had some policy people. So our judges really are not researchers from the university. These are community people.
I would have thought that would make it a little bit easier, although I know what you're saying about you have to make it so that they can understand it, but I thought maybe it would take the pressure off because they're not academics. They're not people that you're dealing with on a regular basis within the confines of the university.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. There is a different type of pressure. It's not the pressure of being, or to use a research term, reliability or validity of your results. That's not what the focus is here. The focus really is accessibility. And we always tell participants who may be thinking about this or maybe considering entering into this competition, it's that old notion of the elevator speech. Or you have an uncle who's at your dinner table who asks, so what are you doing at school? This person probably doesn't want to hear the half-hour version of your details of your research and how you've addressed issues of reliability. But to get this down to a brief, fun, accessible, community accessed 3 minutes, your uncle's still awake.
Well, maybe some people's uncles are still awake, yeah. But there you go. Do contestants go into this cold, or do they get any kind of coaching ahead of time?
Yeah, well, we just finished 2 information sessions. So Brock students who are interested in this, in the local level competition, we had some information sessions. We have a 3-minute thesis website at Brock. So we try to get that information out there, because I think that students, if they haven't seen a 3-minute thesis, and we've only had one at Brock, it's hard to know what it really is. So we try to prepare students. And I think a lot of the participants are cautious and nervous about this, but we try to make it as informal, the preparation for it. So we do provide a lot of information sessions before they make the decision to apply to this. And then after they apply, we actually hold workshops for them. And the workshops are aimed at providing them with the tools around the skills we've been talking about, not so much what your research is, because I don't think anyone knows that as well as the participant themselves. But we have someone who is from drama, who can talk about how to make eye contact with your audience members, how to project your voice properly. We talked last year about things you don't really think about, what you do with your hands during a presentation, how to project to the far end of the auditorium. These are skills as academics we don't typically think about, but we try to provide that coaching for students and participants as they prep for their 3-minute thesis talk.
Who's eligible to take part?
This is aimed at graduate students. So these are master students who are completing their thesis or major research project, or PhD students. We suggest that students are at the latter stages of their research. So they are not necessarily done their thesis, but they have some data, they have some results. Even if you have defended, but you haven't graduated, you are eligible for this competition.
What's the time frame for the local competition? Because I presume it's coming up soon.
Right. To give you a bit of history on this, last year was our first year that we ran this. We ran it with the Faculty of Graduate Studies and tied it up to their Mapping the New Knowledges Conference. We're doing that again this year. The Mapping Knowledges Conference is on Monday, April 7th. Last year, we had 6 competitors in the 3-minute thesis. This year, based on the feedback we've had from that, we expect a few more. So we've decided to have preliminary rounds. And the preliminary rounds will be held during the week of the 24th of February. And depending on our numbers, we will have 2 or 3 preliminary rounds, and we'll select the top 2 or 3 from these rounds who will go on to the competition during our 3-minute thesis day during our conference on Monday, April 7th. So the deadline to submit an application to the 3-minute thesis is January 24th.
On a local level, what does the winner receive other than the accolades of their peers, which goes without saying?
This is nice for students because the winner will receive $500 from the Faculty of Graduate Studies and an expenses paid trip to compete at the Ontario competition. We also have a runner-up prize of $250 for our second place finisher.
Where's the website for people who want more information?
The website for the Brock competition as well as the Ontario competition can be found at the Faculty of Graduate Studies website at Brock.
I have to ask you, you've done your thesis.
I have.
I want to ask, first of all, what it was on and whether you think you could handle the 3-minute thesis yourself.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. My doctoral thesis, which I completed at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, was on learning disabilities and particularly working memory in working memory deficits in children with learning disabilities. It's interesting, though, because it was a very experimental thesis, a very experimental study. And since that time, I've recognized in myself that I enjoy applied work, and I think my strengths may lie in applied research. So I really have moved towards that notion of bringing research to the community, and perhaps that's why I was attracted to the 3-minute thesis and have become part of that organizing committee. At the time I did my thesis, it's an interesting question to think whether I'd be good at the 3-minute thesis competition. I'm not sure. It really relies on a different skill set. And I think I was just developing my presentation skill set at that time. So I certainly wouldn't have done as well as some of our participants last year. And Mike, I have to say that going to the Ontario competition, the presenters there were absolutely terrific at what they did. I'm thinking of the people who placed first and second and third, and they were amazing at taking very complex phenomenon and presenting it with style and presenting it with humor. And those skill sets I don't think I had when I did my thesis. But I'll tell you, I've seen students at Brock who really do walk that fine balance line between being exceptional researchers and exceptional academics and also being able to take those complex ideas and really deliver them to an audience who are not in their immediate research circles.
It's a daunting task. I don't think I could ever do it myself. So I know where you're coming from. I've never had to do it. But age is an amazing thing. When you talk about, I don't think I could do it back then, isn't experience a wonderful thing? If you were to do it now, you'd probably be a little more, not so much relaxed, but confident in your skills now than when you were much younger in those student days. Experience counts for so much.
Absolutely. I think that's true. And I think you're correct. I think I'd feel more comfortable and I'd probably just plain do better now. It's one of the challenges for our guys because I know that our students who are in this 3-minute thesis competition are just starting their academic careers and they're just starting their presentation-based careers.
Let's talk about your research before we run out of time
here.
You're currently working with the Learning Disabilities Association of Niagara, where you are the president of the board of directors, I understand.
That's right.
Just what specifically are you working on?
Right now, I do partner with the Learning Disabilities Association of Niagara. I work very closely with their executive director, Ashley Short. And I would say all of my research is based in the community. What we are focused on is building effective programming for our children, particularly young children who are experiencing reading difficulties and reading disabilities. I have a research team at Brock, and we work at developing the most effective empirically based instructional programs for children with reading disabilities. So we have a big team working on these projects.
As a parent, when and how should they be noticing if their child has a reading disability?
Yeah, that's almost a $1 million question. It's a fine line. I think you don't want to press any panic buttons when children are very young, because there's a lot of factors that go into development, and children develop at different rates. But there are certainly some things that happen that point parents to the notion that they should be getting some support. One of them is how well children are doing at school. And if you're hearing things from your teacher, I think that's a big risk factor when you're talking with your child's teacher and you're hearing things like they need some extra support or they're falling behind their peers. That's when most parents come to us as our research team or the Learning Disabilities Association, is that when they hear from their schools that something is happening that they need to pay attention to. That's when we see these kids.
Yeah, because the teachers are trained to pick up on these things far sooner than most parents would.
Absolutely. And being a parent myself, I know that you're not the most objective when it comes to your own kids. But I think teachers, and again, in our program in Child and Youth Studies, we work with a lot of teachers. And I think teachers are perhaps the most skilled in order to recognize some of those risk factors that may require a bit of support.
So what's the first thing that a parent should do? Panic is obviously off the table, but what should they do?
Yeah, and I think panic is a typical response. I mean, having kids, again, we panic a lot about a lot of things. I think that developing a strong relationship with your child's teacher is probably our number one recommendation, and getting a team-based approach to support your child. And that would be the teacher, the principal or vice principal, learning resource teacher. And if it's deemed that we could use some external support, then a place like the Learning Disabilities Association really works. They offer a lot of programs. We have programs that are offered at very little cost or even no cost to our Niagara families. And these programs are designed just to support these needs. I think that team-based approach is really an effective way to deal with anything that comes up.
Now, just getting back briefly to the three-minute thesis, I'd be interested, once we know who the winner is from Brock, I'd like to have that person on the program and deliver their three-minute thesis here on Inquisitive Minds. I'd like to see if we could set that up afterwards.
I think that's a terrific idea. And the representative from Brock is certainly going to need as much practice as they can get. So delivering their three-minute thesis on air would be terrific.
All right, we'll work on that. John, thank you very much for coming in. This has all been fascinating, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about the three-minute thesis as it comes up.
You're welcome, Mike. My pleasure.
And that was Dr. John McNamara, an educational psychologist at Brock, on some of his research and, of course, the three-minute thesis coming up very soon. In fact, the deadline for applications is January 24th, not far away at all. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind.